Hey, this is Amanda, women's health dietitian.
And I'm Emily, nutritional therapy practitioner.
And this is the Are You Menstrual podcast, where we help you navigate the confusing world of women's hormones and teach you how to have healthy periods.
Each week, we will be diving into a different topic on women's health and sharing our perspective using nutrition, female physiology, and metabolic health.
Our goal is to help you wade through conflicting health information and empower you on your healing journey.
We hope you enjoy it.
In this episode, we are back for round two with Lauren De La Cruz, or you may know her as Innate Functional Nutrition on Instagram. To expand on our last episode, we really focused on preconception there, talking about like preparing your body to conceive, timelines for all that kind of stuff. But in this episode, we really want to dig more into nutrition for pregnancy specifically. And if you didn't listen to the last episode, quick little synopsis of Lauren and kind of her career, what she does in this field. Lauren is a functional nutritional therapy practitioner, root cause protocol consultant, and functional diagnostic nutrition practitioner that specializes in preconception nutrition. Her mission is to empower women with the tools and the knowledge they need to regulate their cycles, balance their hormones, heal their metabolism, optimize their fertility, and have a thriving pregnancy. So of course, that's why she came to mind when I was creating this series. And honestly, there's a lot of fear around nutrition and pregnancy. It seems like, especially, and I'm sure you see this a lot too, Lauren, with like the women that follow you, that your clients and stuff, they make all these changes, right? Maybe they start beef liver, maybe they start with adrenal cocktails and making more conscious choices around nutrient-dense foods. And they might even change their supplements. You know, maybe they're like rethinking the D and the zinc and all that kind of stuff. And then they get pregnant and they're like, wait, what am I supposed to do? Like everything all of a sudden like goes out the window, I feel like. And they're like kind of back on the supplements that maybe weren't the best options as far as like optimizing minerals and stuff goes. They're afraid to eat certain foods, even though a lot of that stuff likely helped them with their fertility. So the goal with this episode is to help remove a lot of that fear around nutrition during pregnancy and hopefully clear up some of that confusion. So I'm super happy to have you here.
Oh, thanks so much for having me again. I'm super excited to be here and excited to chat with you.
And we covered a lot in the last episode for preconception. Like we talked about vitamin D, folates, prenatals, a lot of different things that obviously they're applicable for pregnancy, but I also think most women start thinking about those during conception. So why don't we get started with probably the most common question that I get? And that is around foods to avoid during pregnancy. Things like raw fish, sushi, deli meats, high mercury seafood, like being told not to eat things like tuna, raw milk, runny egg yolks, soft cheeses, all that kind of stuff. So like maybe you can break down why we're told to avoid these and then your perspective on including these foods during pregnancy.
Yeah, of course. That's a really great way to start this episode. There are definitely questions that cross a lot of women's minds when they first get pregnant and they're like trying to figure out what they can and can't eat. And there is a lot of, you know, definitely interesting information out there. A lot of it, I think, has been passed down from a lot of dogmatic views of nutrition. And I think the most important thing to understand, too, is, as you know very well, most of the information that they're receiving is from their doctor, and doctors aren't trained in nutrition. They maybe get, you know, a couple hours, maybe a course if they're super lucky in nutrition. But, you know, these kinds of questions, they're usually answering them based on their very limited knowledge of nutrition, especially nutrition during pregnancy. So, you know, gotta preface that there. It's not that, you know, they're necessarily trying to do this on purpose, but it's just a lack of awareness, I should say. So why we're told to avoid these is usually fear of foodborne illness and or compounds within the food that are seen as quote unquote risky. For example, a couple of examples here. Deli meat contains Listeria, eggs potentially contain Salmonella, soft cheeses potentially contain Listeria, raw oysters potentially contain, you know, this bacteria called Vibrio vulnificus. I'm not even sure if I pronounced that right, but, and you know, seafood contains mercury. These are definitely, there is potential, but I think what most people don't understand is that every food has the potential to cause foodborne illness. And it's not just animal foods either. I think a lot of people think, you know, okay, I'm going to avoid eating, you know, eggs and cheese and deli meat because of these things, and I'll stick to my salad and I'll be safe there. But really, when you look at the data, and I think Lily Nichols has done a really good job of explaining this. When you break it down, it's pretty much 50-50. You know, you can get foodborne illness from plant-based foods or animal-based foods pretty equally. So it's not necessarily, you know, you're dodging a bullet by avoiding animal foods. And then, you know, what are you eating instead of those nutrient-dense foods? What are you replacing them with? So I think that that's really important to kind of consider. When we look at a couple of these foods, let's start with raw milk, for example. You know, unlike its cousin, soft cheese, I don't believe it has the potential to contain listeria. So we're pretty much in the clear. And the reason we worry so much about listeria is that this pathogen can potentially cause miscarriage if we get sick with it. That's the risk there. And that's why people are so afraid of listeria. If you're getting raw milk from a really high quality source, your risk for getting foodborne illness from raw milk is pretty insignificant. It's like 0.0005 or something, or 4. So it's pretty low. And, you know, you're like tens of thousands times more likely to contract foodborne illness from other foods other than raw milk. And because there's so much focus, or I guess a magnifying glass, on raw milk producers, they tend to have even more hygienic practices than your regular conventional milk producers. So that's, you know, an example there. Runny eggs, you know, doctors often say, make sure to cook your egg yolks all the way through. And the reason for that is, you know, salmonella, like I mentioned earlier, which could potentially make someone very ill. But what also most people don't realize is that salmonella is a topical bacteria. So when you are consuming eggs, it's really the eggshell that is most likely to contain the salmonella. And if you crack it incorrectly and, you know, maybe you've dropped the shell in and it has salmonella, then your egg might contain salmonella. But there is a rule for most supermarkets and most conventional egg producers that they have to actually sterilize the outside because of this anyway. But I will say that if you get pasture-raised eggs, you're about 7 times less likely to get salmonella from eggs, especially if they're coming from an organic farm. So really, sourcing matters in most of these cases. Of course, you really want to make sure you trust the source. And of course, preparation matters too. But this is another example where, you know, it's really down to, okay, how carefully am I preparing the food and where is it coming from? Because there's really not too much to worry about in that case. And there's one case of salmonella in, you know, 1 to 12 or 30,000 eggs. So it's really, if you get it from a good source and you prepare it properly, you're pretty in the clear and you can enjoy your runny egg. The next one is raw cheese. And here the concern is listeria. And I will say there's interesting sort of stances on raw cheese. The Weston A. Price Foundation does say to avoid this, but Lily Nichols, registered dietitian, she says to, it's really up to you. And so it's, again, another instance where you want to weigh the risks versus the benefits. If you really want raw cheese, raw cheese can be a great source. And, you know, regular pasteurized cheese too, but raw soft cheese can potentially contain listeria. It's like one case in 5 million servings.
That's so low. It's just like, I know the concern. I understand why it's there. But I think a lot of this, I'm like, I feel like we're using this energy and putting it in the wrong place, you know?
Oh, I'm 100% with you. There's so many other things that, you know, we do during pregnancy that are like, okay, you're not going to eat a runny egg, but you're going to do this. And, you know, it's not coming from a judgmental place, but it's like, okay, if we can take a step back before we try to freak, or before we start freaking out about anything, like, let's just have a reality check.
And it's just what society is focusing on. Like, I can't tell you how many clients are like, I can't eat deli meat. And sometimes it's one of the only proteins they can tolerate. They just want sandwiches in that first trimester. And I'm like, we just have to use our food safety skills that most of us have. If you make food at home, you know, like, I'm not going to let it sit in the fridge for too long. And like, don't, if you open deli meat on Sunday and it's the next Sunday, maybe don't eat that same deli meat, you know? So it's, but I get it. It's scary.
It can be. And, you know, I'm not one to judge or any, you know, where someone's fear is coming from. Could be they've had a really bad experience with a particular food and they really don't want to mess with it. And I get that. I've had food poisoning before and it's really not fun. just, you know, taking the emotion out of the equation, just looking at the numbers and sort of the reality of the situation, you know, you can make a decision to eat these foods if you're comfortable with the risks. And that's really what this is all about. So, raw cheese, you know, up to you. a couple more too. Raw fish. So this is interesting too. Sushi grade fish is usually flash frozen to kill pathogens. So, and there's a couple of cultures and countries that do recommend it as part of a prenatal diet. So especially in Japan, where raw fish consumption is really, really common. So of course, what, you know, sourcing matters again, preparation matters again. Wild caught is going to be really high quality, going to provide a lot more nutrients. The way that they're raised in farm-raised, fisheries, you know, there's a lot more potential to, I guess, more access to bacteria-infested fish. They usually do give them sort of antibiotics because they're in enclosed areas and really tight-knit, and the foods that they're feeding them are not super great. So, you know, wild-caught, I would say, is probably what you want to go with, but definitely, you know, it's really up to you whether raw fish is the only way that you eat fish and say you can't stomach anything else, like any other proteins, then you might want to consider eating raw fish and having that sushi, as long as it's from a place that you trust. I will say, though, that rule does not apply to raw shellfish. So things like lobster, crab, scallops, oysters, clams. So the bacteria that I mentioned before with oysters, that is pretty considerably, that's pretty considerable. And I would probably make sure, if you did want oysters, to have them smoked or cooked. And that goes for any other shellfish there. Deli meat too. You know, I know women that like microwave their deli meat so that they work around them. And that sounds just so terrible to me.
Or making like a grilled ham and cheese, you know, like cooking it or something, like I feel like you could do, make it maybe taste a little better.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Italian sandwiches, sometimes the warm meat is like delicious and amazing, but I don't think you have to like microwave it if you want to eat it. For deli meat, there's like one case of Listeria in about 83,000 servings. So again, it's really up to you and if you want to take that risk. But of course, you can mitigate your risk further by properly preparing it, making sure you're getting it from a good source, etc. So just some numbers there. The sources for that primarily are the Weston A. Price Foundation and Lily Nichols, Real Food for Pregnancy. I will also say, in terms of mercury, that also is definitely a really interesting topic too. Like, a lot of women are avoiding fish and avoiding seafood because they're scared of high mercury content. And yes, there are fish that do contain higher amounts of mercury, like swordfish and like tuna. But really those, and that's because they're larger fish and they live longer and they tend to accumulate these toxins in higher amounts. But, you know, it's really, again, just because there's this one potential doesn't mean we need to cross this whole thing off our list. You know, there's reasonable middle roads here that we can take. And so the interesting part about mercury is that gut bacteria can actually trap mercury-containing food and prevent it from being absorbed. So good gut function is going to support you in terms of mitigating the effect of mercury on you and your fetus. Getting sufficient selenium. So again, seafood also has tons of selenium in it. It binds to mercury, which is great. And so glutathione as well can also protect against mercury. Raw milk is a great source of that. And also good copper status will also influence mercury levels. So making sure you have good copper status. And again, seafood is also a great source of copper. So nature, I don't know if I mentioned this last time, but nature kind of provides foods in like this amazing, beautiful package. So, you know, again, it's up to you. If you really like seafood and, you know, it's one of your primary proteins, like you might want to just consider this information and, you know, work that into your nutrition approach for pregnancy.
Yeah, I feel like it can be hard because on one hand, I understand why they make such generic statements because it's like they're trying to give a very large population nutrition advice, which is hard. I mean, I think about like the stuff I post on Instagram. I'm like, there's not enough room for nuance here, but there's so much more nuance than what I can fit into a caption. You know, like I understand the general recommendations, but I hope that as women listen to this podcast, maybe they're doing more research, doing your course, reading Real Food for Pregnancy, going into the Weston A. Price Foundation, looking at their blogs, you can start to educate yourself and see like what do I feel comfortable with like risk-wise? And, you know, because you just listed all the numbers, the likelihood of getting that foodborne illness exposure is much lower when it's properly prepared, when you're being smart about food safety. And like sourcing and everything. So I feel like there are so many ways to include these foods and not to necessarily be afraid of them. I think the thing that's sad is it requires so much more education, you know, and not everyone has access to that. So hopefully people listen to this podcast and share it. But I mean, a lot of these foods can be very nourishing and they're really healthy and they're things you were eating before. So it's like if you have a raw fish source that you really trust, then I wouldn't necessarily be worried about including that during pregnancy. There's way more iodine in raw fish. A lot of women crave sushi during pregnancy, likely for that reason, or we need more iodine then. So it's like, I would also like listen to your body. Like, do you really want those foods, you know? And it doesn't have to be this like crazy all or nothing approach.
Totally. I think that's really well said and well balanced view of nutrition during pregnancy. It doesn't have to be either extreme. There's a lot of gray area that you could take advantage of.
Hey, Amanda here, just giving you a quick break, hopefully a break for your brain in the middle of this podcast episode, to remind you that if you haven't gone through our free training, Optimizing Hormone Health Through Mineral Balance, we really do recommend starting there. And the main reason for that is because you're going to hear us say things like mineral foundation, having a solid foundation, are you putting the foundations in place? Especially as we get deeper and deeper into different hormonal topics and specific imbalances in the body, the mineral foundation is always going to be so essential. So if you haven't watched the free training, you can find it in our show notes or you can go to hormonehealingrd.com and it's going to be right on that front page there. But we really recommend starting there so that you can understand how is your current mineral status, how do you assess this, and how to get started with all that, just so you can get as much as you possibly can out of the rest of the podcast episodes. But that's it. I hope you enjoy the rest of this episode. So let's talk about beef liver, because that's another very controversial food. And it's probably the most common supplement that I get clients asking, like, I stopped taking the beef liver because I'm pregnant, or should I stop taking it? My doctor told me not to take beef liver during pregnancy. Why is this such a controversial food or supplement, kind of depending how someone's taking it during this time?
Yeah, great question. It goes back to a lot of what I mentioned earlier, where, you know, doctors are not really trained on nutrition very much. And so the issue with that too is they're focusing on other things, and they also are not staying on top of the literature either. It's just their job is too large. They have too little time to be able to do that. So the main controversy around liver is primarily due to its high vitamin A content, so high retinol content. And this is preformed vitamin A, not beta carotene. And this is, you know, the really good stuff that our body needs to differentiate properly. It supports our immune system. It supports the differentiation of baby, symmetry, their immune system, eye development, lung development, or other organ development. It's so important. I think our ancestors were doing something right too, because this was typically part of the preconception and pregnancy diet. They knew liver and other organ meats were high in this nutrient, and it was really essential for not only supporting the baby, but also mother's health and healing. So the controversy comes back to a 1995 study that found that women that consumed more than 10,000 IU of vitamin A gave birth to children with a greater risk of specific birth defects. Like many other studies, though, this one was flawed. And much of the vitamin A content that, you know, they were surveying in the foods were from multivitamins or fortified food sources. So they really didn't distinguish synthetic, which, you know, if you want to fortify food with vitamin A, it's going to be synthetic. So they weren't distinguishing between synthetic vitamin A or natural vitamin A. That was the really primary issue with that study. But unfortunately, this led to the interpretation that all rich sources of vitamin A must be bad, because regardless of whether it's synthetic or natural. And unfortunately, this misinformation has been carried through decades. So it's really unfortunate because liver is such a nourishing food. It's got so many other nutrients that are so important for baby's development and pregnancy. So there have been other studies following this one that show exponentially higher vitamin A intake and have either no correlation with birth defects or actually lower birth defects. So, you know, go figure there. Liver is rich in vitamin A, and it's also rich in many other nutrients like choline, folate, other B vitamins, copper. And, you know, it's such an important food, and to completely avoid this food because of fear of this high level of vitamin A, which, you know, if you have a little bit, it's really difficult. It's, first of all, it's really difficult to like stomach a lot of liver. Mm-hmm. And you're only going to probably have it a couple times a week. And the actual supplements, they really don't have a lot in all the caps. Like, you're not going to be getting an exponential dose of vitamin A in those caps. So it's relatively fine. And what's beautiful too is I mentioned a couple other nutrients that it has, but also it has nutrients that allow it to function properly in the body, like other fat soluble vitamins like vitamin K. And, you know, so it's again, an instance where nature kind of gift wraps this beautiful food for you with all the amazing other nutrients that it needs to function properly. So that's kind of where I go. And, you know, if you are scared of liver, like, it's definitely one of the only food sources, the richest food sources of vitamin A out there. And it's really, really nourishing. And you're going to hit so many other nutrient needs by eating it. I will say, if you are worried about your vitamin A intake, I would look at what prenatals you're taking or fortified foods you're also intaking versus something that's so natural that your body will actually know what to do with.
That's such a good point. Because most prenatals I see they usually have the beta carotene version, which is obviously not the preformed. Your body then has to convert it, but it is added to different foods. It's added to milk, certain dairy products, because they're trying to refortify, get that A and D in there, even though it's usually already present. I think that's really good advice, and hopefully remove some of the fear for people. It is. It's truly the vitamin A, even though most women I see are very low in vitamin A. Their retinol status is low, especially as they kind of move through pregnancy, because we are, you know, it's such a big demand on the body. So that I usually will say, if someone can just get a retinol blood test, they're not that expensive. You can order it online from some place like Request a Test. That's usually what I recommend if they're like, I don't feel comfortable taking the beef liver or eating beef liver because my doctor said this about the vitamin A. I'm like, why don't you just test and see if you need it? I think that's the other thing that's difficult. I know not everyone has access to testing, but you can pay $60 for a retinol test. And it's, if you're worried about consuming beef liver, taking it during pregnancy, that could be one of those things that, whew, that takes a big stress off of you. And you know, actually, I do need this. And this could even help me piece a few things together later, like iron deficiency during the third trimester. So let's go there next, since we're already talking about vitamin A. Why are so many women told that they're anemic, especially during like that second half of pregnancy?
Yeah. So iron deficiency anemia is pretty common, or at least it's... I wish I had the stats right in front of me. I don't know what percentage of women get it, but because I deal with iron deficiency anemia and I'm in the space that I'm in, I do get a lot of women reaching out to me like, hey, I just got my hemoglobin tested. I'm in the third trimester and my midwife is saying I have to get my iron up. Otherwise, I can't do my home birth or like, yeah. I got to get it up to deliver for delivery. So I will first say that there's a lot going on in the third trimester. So, and there's a lot of natural changes that can lead to natural decreases in iron levels in the body. So estrogen is at its highest, and this matters because higher estrogen levels are correlated with lower hemoglobin levels. So just with that, there's a huge, pregnancy is very hormonal, and the third trimester is like the peak of the hormone. So keep that in mind. There's also a huge transfer of nutrients to baby in the third trimester. So this includes iron and copper, and so hemoglobin levels will naturally drop, And copper enzyme called zyklopen is a really supportive enzyme that allows the transfer of iron to baby as well. So that's just a side note. But what that means is that, and what I'm trying to get at is that when there's an increased need for iron, there's also usually an increased need for copper and vitamin A. I can't remember if we went over that last podcast, but
I don't think we did.
Okay. Well, yeah. So iron requires copper to function properly. You know, a lot of nutrients, there's no nutrient that really operates on its own. It's going to have many partners and cofactors, and iron's cofactors and partners include copper, as well as vitamin A, which is kind of an ancillary partner, but really important because it also activates copper and has a relationship with copper. So, you know, given the relationship between these three nutrients, if we need more iron, usually we might actually need more copper or vitamin A, because what happens without copper and vitamin A is iron is a very volatile metal, and it feeds pathogens in the body. And so what the body will do is, if there's not enough of the cofactors to manage it properly, it will remove the iron from the bloodstream and sequester it into the tissues away from the pathogens, because pathogens love to feed on iron, and the body doesn't want to, you know, sort of feed this potential illness that you might have in the bloodstream. So it sequesters it, and it can also make it look like we have anemia. So, you know, that could also be part of the sort of lowering of iron in the third trimester. We've been hyper-focusing on iron, but not enough of the cofactors. And the body may just not have enough to manage iron properly. Or, you know, once you download to baby two, the body's prioritizing baby. So, you know, it's going to need the other cofactors to then create new red blood cells and utilize the iron recycling system, which is made up of a bunch of organs. And so there's this really amazing system in the body that allows you to recycle iron really efficiently. So we actually don't need too much, but these other two nutrients, copper and vitamin A, are really, really essential to make this run properly. So we might be missing that. Again, medical practice tends to focus on the increased need for iron in pregnancy, but they forget the other two nutrients. And so, you know, we end up taking iron pills or getting iron infusions, and that's really unfortunate because a lot of women experience, at least the ones that I've worked with that have had these things arise in the past, they basically say like, my health has never been the same, or like, I've had this issue since I've had to take an iron infusion for, you know, the third trimester with my previous son or my last child. So it's hard, and it sucks because a lot of women experience a lot of pressure from their medical providers. Like I just said, for the example that I gave in the beginning, like, midwives do give ultimatums, like, you know, and it sucks because a woman might not be able to give birth the way that they want to just because of this thing that, you know, I will actually talk a little bit more about that, you know, we might be looking at it incorrectly. So Again, I will also clarify too, the reason the ultimatums are given is because low iron is thought to be cause a bleeding out during delivery. So that is definitely a very serious consideration and concern. But you know, it's tough because there is other research that I would love to see more research expanded upon that could potentially help ease the concern here. So there was a study done by Dr. Lee, and he's an OBGYN, and he measured the levels of hemoglobin in about 1,000 of his patients. And he found that the healthiest babies were born to mothers that had hemoglobin levels of 8.5 to 9.5, which is way lower than the low end of the ultimatums that doctors and midwives are putting on women. I think the lowest, you know, they'll say is like maybe 11. Otherwise, you have to give birth at the hospital. And, you know, even if you are giving birth at the hospital, your doctor will probably say, get on iron pills if you're lower than 11. So that's considerably lower than that sort of low end of the threshold there. But, you know, what he witnessed was healthy babies and healthy moms. And there's other interesting research that correlates the level of copper in the liver to hemorrhaging. And so low levels of copper in the liver are associated with higher levels of hemorrhaging, so bleeding out, or higher levels of copper in the liver are associated with lower levels of bleeding out. So, you know, I would, again, these are very like unknown or not well-known pieces of research that I'm citing here. And I would definitely love to see somebody do more. But it's just very interesting because it, you know, it does kind of nod to what we were talking about in the relationships between iron and copper and vitamin A. And I also should mention, you know, in the 1930s, so almost 100 years ago, there were three doctors that won the Nobel Prize for curing anemia with beef liver, because beef liver contains iron, copper, and vitamin A. So it's just really interesting. So if you are struggling with iron deficiency anemia in the third trimester, I would definitely look into, you know, making sure you're getting enough of the other nutrients that are required to manage iron properly. And a great way to do that is with beef liver.
And that brings us back to the beef liver. But I think like the biggest thing, because a lot of it comes back to, I feel like we're so worried about rules within pregnancy, whether it's like a rule from our doctor or midwife, whatever provider we're working with. And we're like, well, I have to meet this level because of this. When the sad part for me, like listening to you kind of talk it out about how it's like, well, it is part of it's very natural, right? It's a natural occurrence during that third trimester because of all the hormonal changes, all the download of the nutrients to the baby, you're going to have a lower hemoglobin level. That's why the ranges are different for pregnancy. But the sad part is that if it's lower, the only solution that you're given is that it's an iron issue. It's never looked any further because bleeding out is that's a very big concern, right? For giving birth. Well, what if iron's not the problem and it's actually a copper issue? So this woman's taking iron and it doesn't do anything. It doesn't help her with the bleeding at all for birth. That's like to me, I'm like, that's not fair. You know, it's not fair for the woman that's giving birth that she's not getting all the information. And it, like you said, this is not new information. The iron recycling system, like we've known about this for a while. We've known that beef liver cured iron deficiency anemia for a very long time, since the 1930s. So it's sad that we kind of look at these like vitamin D and iron as these like single measurements, and we're not kind of expanding and utilizing the knowledge that we have around what about those other nutrients that are going to impact these levels. It's like we want to simplify it too much. And then it's too bad for the moms out there. Anyone that's impacted by the conventional, you know, medical system, that they're not really getting the answers that they want, the help that they need. It's just, I'm like, that's like a bummer, you know? And I think, yes, a woman can hear this and feel like, well, I don't really know what to do. You know, like, should I take the iron? Do I take the beef liver? I mean, it's totally up to you, but I would also not be afraid to ask your doctor for other testing, you know, and ask why, ask questions, ask them and test your copper, test your retinol, make sure it's retinol, because otherwise they'll test beta carotene. But, you know, like ask for the test, tell them why. I'm going to put some resources in the show notes for this that Lauren mentioned, and just a little bit more on like testing your levels and stuff like that. It doesn't have to be so unknown and scary. It's just, it does require you to really step up and kind of advocate for yourself.
Yeah, for sure. I think self-advocacy is definitely a learned skill because, you know, I feel like I myself just having, from my experience, I've just kind of always not questioned things. And when it started to go downhill, my health, I think I shared on the last podcast, that's when I actually started seeing results and like actually understanding more and seeing differences and huge differences in my health. So you don't always have to say yes, yes, you know, you can poke and prod. You have the right to, it's your body and your baby. And yeah, that was really well said. I definitely agree. It's such a tough position because, you know, women don't want to do anything that could potentially hurt the baby. And they certainly don't want to be told that you have the potential to bleed out during delivery if you don't get your iron levels up. That's, of course, really terrifying. I think we could definitely approach it, though, from a practitioner standpoint, a little bit better and a little bit more open-minded. Because I have even heard stories from women coming to me that they say they did take the iron supplements and then they did bleed out. And so that wasn't solving the problem, obviously. I will say if it has worked in the past, getting iron levels up in the third trimester, it is probably because taking that iron can sometimes force the body to release copper and vitamin A temporarily. And so that's why you'll have a temporary increase in hemoglobin and it'll look like it's normal again. But what happens is very shortly after that, maybe a month or two, that'll drop again. And it'll be this like vicious cycle. Oh, and then, you know, like it works when I take, you know, high doses and then my anemia comes back again. And it's like this constant cycle. And so obviously, like, at least that's what I see in my practice and from people that have worked with me in their past. So I do think that there is this untapped area that we could utilize to not only support the health of mom, but also just make it a lot less stressful. Like, because it is so stressful. And like the last thing a woman in her third trimester needs to be is stressed.
Even if you just think about how we increase our absorption of iron during pregnancy and you're not bleeding, so we're not getting rid of it. So I feel like, and we have a whole episode on copper and iron. I think it's, I was going to say six. I'm not 100% sure, but it's, if you go to my website, you'll see it on there. If you're on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify, it'll be there. It's just like the connection between copper and iron. And you can kind of learn about how they're working. Like Lauren was describing that iron recycling system before. And as soon as you understand that, and then you think, okay, well, I'm increasing my absorption. I'm not losing any iron because I'm not getting my period during this time. For a lot of women, I think it starts to click. And then they're like, okay, well, what could I do instead? Like beef liver, great option, right? Liquid chlorophyll, if you need a lot of copper, if you know that for a fact, like maybe you've done testing, that can be a great option. And I've had so many clients do amazing with cod liver oil in the third trimester. So, and that increased their hemoglobin. And their midwife will say they have to take the iron and they're like, I don't want to do it. Maybe they've had a bad experience in the past. Maybe they have a history of gut issues, but they're like, I don't feel comfortable. What can I do instead? And their levels go up. And then, you know, they're like given the okay to do the home birth. So it's just like, it's definitely sad, but hopefully this gives people a little bit more of like, okay, I'm going to look into this more if this is the case for you, or how to prevent it, right? How to prevent hemoglobin from dropping too low. Cause if it is really a copper or vitamin A concern, you do want to work on that. Another nutrient I get a lot of questions about is calcium. Like a lot of women are like, do I need to supplement with calcium during pregnancy?
Yeah. That is a common question for sure. And I think it's a definitely one that a lot of women think that they need to supplement during pregnancy. Like they're going into pregnancy, okay, I'm going to get my calcium supplement. Like they're ready. They think they have it set in their minds. And, you know, I mean, it kind of makes sense to think that way. But once you understand the needs of the body and all the other stuff that the body's doing during pregnancy to make sure you're getting calcium, it becomes kind of unnecessary, generally speaking. Of course, you know, if you're not sure, you can definitely get a hair tissue mineral analysis or work with your doctor to get other testing done to really understand whether or not you need it. But most women, at least the ones that I've worked with, even non-pregnant women, have never needed calcium. So definitely super common question. I will say that calcium absorption in the intestines doubles during pregnancy. So that's just one fun fact that if you know it, like, you're good. Your body's got your back. It's taking care of things for you. So just that fact that your body's working hard to increase calcium absorption in the intestines is amazing. Another thing to know too is that calcium intake, I should say, from non-pregnancy to pregnancy to postpartum, it's the same throughout. So it's 1,000 milligrams per day. Like, that's the RDA, it doesn't change. So that's something to know too. And, you know, if we might not need as much as we think, especially coming from America, you know, the US here, we do live in a more calcium rich, we consume a more calcium rich diet here. So we tend to need less too. Another thing to know too is if you are going to be supplementing calcium, this is also important to know for like digestive processes, but calcium does compete with other nutrients for absorption, like iron, zinc, and magnesium. So, you know, overdoing it on any one of these nutrients can inhibit the absorption of the others. And so if you're constantly taking, you know, a calcium supplement, you know, you might be one of those people that ends up with iron deficiency anemia in the third trimester. I wish I could have a study done to see.
I know. That would be so interesting.
That would be. But also you're missing out on zinc and magnesium, which are so important too. A deficiency in magnesium during pregnancy is associated with so many other sort of complications. It's insane. So, you know, and that's kind of what's really funny to me about those iron-free prenatals is like those supplement companies are only considering the relationship between iron and calcium there, but there's this whole other world.
I know. And like a lot of it, like it depends on the company making the supplement, but a lot of it's like we're educated in if they have like any sort of nutrition background. So those are difficult. I know. Everyone's like, if you had to pick a prenatal, I'm like, I wouldn't. I can't pick one. Like it hurts my heart to have to pick one. But the calcium thing is interesting. I don't know if you've seen this. I see so many women that can't tolerate dairy when they're not pregnant. And then all of a sudden they can tolerate it during pregnancy and they have it's like all they want
to
eat.
Yeah. I have to have my vanilla ice cream at night, like every day.
Cheese. Everything is cheese. You know, it's just like things that would have given them like a rash before, digestive issues or acne. It's like all of a sudden they're like, oh, I have no issues digesting it now. And it's like one of my favorite foods. And it is very rich in calcium and like vitamin A and stuff. So it just makes, I think it's like the whole calcium thing, how it, you know, absorption like doubles. It's like our bodies are smarter than we know. And that's if someone were going to like walk away from this episode right now, like that's what I would want them to know. We get so afraid during pregnancy. We get so terrified that we're going to eat something wrong or take something that we shouldn't be taking like supplement wise or herbal wise. And it's like we have so many systems in our body that we aren't even aware of that are like on our side, you know, so we don't have to stress as much as we probably are.
Yeah, for sure. I totally agree. And I do love that sort of view, like our body's much smarter. It's definitely more sophisticated than we give it credit for, but it's also like got your back way more than you think. So
this is another one too that I have to ask before I let you go is the morning sickness piece. So this is a huge one a lot of women struggle with. And I often get asked like, is there a way you can avoid it completely? Curious to hear your thoughts on that. But also like if someone is struggling with this, especially like, you know, if they're in that first trimester, what kind of tips would you be able to give to them so that they can hopefully like minimize some of that nausea?
Yeah, of course. Great question. Definitely one that I get a lot. Well, I get a lot of questions like, can you prevent this issue or that issue or this issue in pregnancy? And like 100% prevention is just not possible. I'm sorry to break it to you. It's just not possible with anything. Like, of course, prevention is easier than treating something. And like, that's the goal with like preconception prep and why I'm so passionate about that phase is because once you're in pregnancy, it's really about managing because there's so much stress on the body and it's, you know, it's not necessarily bad stress, but there's just only so many resources to go around. Prevention, I will say, not possible, but that doesn't mean that you have to suffer with it. So, you know, I do get a lot of women coming to me saying, oh my gosh, I'm so miserable. Like, what should I do? And you know, some practitioners will say that we shouldn't pathologize normal pregnancy symptoms like morning sickness. And morning sickness is considered a normal pregnancy symptom. But, you know, when I have so many women coming to me where they feel like complete death and their mental, physical health is suffering, their total like quality of life is just like out the window. You really have to wonder, did nature intend for this? And like, I do think just brushing it off as a normal pregnancy symptom is kind of gaslighting these women. So, you know, I do really sympathize. And while I will say, you know, it's the approach is like, we really can't prevent anything. There are potential things that we could do to mitigate our issues with it. And most of the women that I've worked with leading up to pregnancy, so maybe I've worked with them a couple months leading up to pregnancy, really got their nutrition solid, their cycles down. Like, they're the ones that deal with morning sickness the least. They're the ones that have the least pregnancy complications. They're the ones that, what else? They have actually the least cravings too. So it's just kind of really interesting just from an anecdotal and observational perspective in my practice so far. But, you know, there's a couple of things that could be involved and I'm, you know, some of them potentially due to imbalances, but some might be just natural. So the first half of pregnancy, which is, you know, usually women experience morning sickness in like the first 3 months, the first trimester, the body is in a really anabolic state. So it's an anabolism is like the building sort of phase or I guess building switch. I'm not finding the right word. But if you're anabolic, you're in like this big building phase. And so you need a lot of calories and a lot of nutrients. And your metabolism is like so, so high during this phase. So you need to support that increase in metabolism with the supply. You know, the demands have to meet the supply. And so what we might be experiencing if, you know, we're having morning sickness is we're not meeting the supply with the demands. And it's, you know, definitely tough to do that if you can't eat. But I'll give you a few tips in just a bit. There also could be sort of aspects of progesterone. So and estrogen, I should say. So Dr. Katharina Dalton talks about this a lot in her literature and her books. And what she equates morning sickness to is, okay, you know, the first trimester, the placenta is not fully formed. It's actually, you're actually growing an entirely new organ. And the placenta is what takes over progesterone production in the second and third trimester. So what you have to rely on in terms of progesterone is the empty egg sac that's releasing progesterone, the corpus luteum. And so your egg health, this is why, and again, preconception prep is something I'm so passionate about, that your egg health, your egg quality is going to determine potentially or influence potentially you experiencing morning sickness. Because if we're not producing enough progesterone, we might feel sick. That's kind of her take on it. And definitely from, you know, the sort of tips that I'm about to share with you too, it might work for you. And that sort of might align. Dr. AP talks about excess estrogen. So, you know, and, you know, I also think it could also be the increased levels of relaxin. But he talks about it affecting the digestive system and it's slowing things down and digestion definitely slows down during pregnancy. So, you know, we might feel nauseous because certain sphincters in the digestive tract are kind of like opening and closing. And so we might feel nauseous that way, kind of like indigestion, that kind of nauseous feeling. So many, many different aspects, nutrient deficiencies as well, you know, magnesium deficiency, vitamin B6, other B vitamins have been associated with morning sickness. So there's really, it's hard to say what might cause it. And it's also hard to say what might be the thing that, you know, nips it in the bud for you, because everyone is so different. And just from having worked with so many women, like there's not one specific thing that works for everyone, except for balancing blood sugar and eating small meals. So that is literally the one consistent thing that works for mostly everyone that I work with. You know, we don't want to have too big of a meal, but we don't want to have too small a meal or just a carb heavy meal. We want to really focus on balancing our blood sugar with proteins, carbs, and fats, because that's what's going to keep us satiated. That's what's going to support our metabolism, because remember, the metabolism is super elevated. And we might need small meals because, again, we're burning through food really, really quickly. And so we might need to eat more frequently too. And so you might want to try small, frequent meals and make sure they're super balanced with protein and carb. Don't try not to have a carb only meal. Like, you know, if you can only stomach juice, like, okay. But if you're going to eat like a slice of toast, like try to have a little bit of butter on it, or maybe an egg if you can stomach that, or some cheese alongside with it, just something to help balance your blood sugar a little bit more. And then in terms of other things, you know, making sure you're sitting, eating up. I mean, that sounds really like common sense, but like, that's a really big game changer too. You may want to also, try having somebody else prepare your food for you. Maybe have less aromatic meals. So like less smelly things, you know, fish and meat tends to be really difficult for a lot of women during this period. So maybe you focus on things like high quality dairy and, you know, eggs and broths during this time. Lean on those proteins a little bit more. Other things you could also look into are homeopathic remedies. So work with a homeopath. They'll have pregnancy safe things that you could potentially take that will also help quell morning sickness. But also you could just look into supplementing B6. That is really common to be, it's a really common queller of morning sickness, as well as magnesium, also been shown to quell morning sickness. And the last thing I'll say is you may also be interested in trying topical progesterone or oral progesterone, so bioidentical progesterone. Depending on how bad it is, depending on who you're working with, depending on who you trust, you can try your doctor and see if they'll work with you on that. Likely, they'll give you a synthetic form of progesterone, so that might not be the ideal version for you, but you can try, which you know are available online, bioidentical progesterone. It comes from directly from Yams. And that could work very nicely. I know several women that have utilized that successfully. And that's actually what Katharina Dalton did.
Yeah, she's a huge proponent of progesterone.
So that could be, you know, you might need one thing, you might need two things. Like it's really mix and matching. Also, you know, make sure you're getting the right nutrients too. I think indigestion too could also cause morning sickness, heartburn, that kind of stuff. So make sure you're eating mindfully, and you could explore bitters or something like that too.
I know it's so, I feel like morning sickness is so complex, you know, but it's like, do the basics first. Like make sure you're eating regularly. I've seen balancing meals be the biggest thing for people, and just not letting themselves like wait too long. For most people, it's 2 hours. Some women, it's an hour and a half. So it, and like that will probably change and evolve as you go throughout your first trimester. One of my clients was getting so overwhelmed with like having to constantly make food to eat. And I'm like, why don't you just cut your meals in half? Like make slightly larger meals, cut them in half, eat those throughout the day. And I mean, that was basically the thing that was like night and day for her. She started sleeping better. You know, she wasn't waking up at nighttime as much. So it's, you have to like find what works for you, and it doesn't have to be perfect. But I will say, like, try to do the protein first, get a little bit of protein first, follow it with the carb. Even if you don't love the protein, it will make a big difference and likely make it so that your whole day is better. But those are really great tips. And I think it's a combination of like, I've read a lot of stuff about like HCG increasing. And then like after 10 weeks, your HCG levels, like they're pretty consistent. And so a lot of women don't experience nausea after that time. So there's probably so many different things depending on the person and their health history. And, you know, did they take hormonal birth control? Like so many different things that are going to impact those levels. But I think those are super solid tips that people can like walk away and implement, or at least like have in the back of their minds if maybe that, maybe they're not feeling that yet, but like for when that could possibly come during pregnancy.
For sure. Yeah, totally.
Well, thank you so much, Lauren, for sharing your knowledge again. I did want to cover a little bit on heartburn and stuff, but we can do that on our live. So I have plenty of questions for the live because I feel like at this point, it's like hopefully people feel better and like, okay, like there are like strategies to work on a lot of these things. I don't need as many supplements as I thought maybe if they were worried about calcium, and hopefully feel more confident in like their food choices around pregnancy. But I can't recommend enough to follow Lauren on Instagram. She's at Innate Functional Nutrition. And if you're like, maybe you're still in the conception timeframe, or even if you already are pregnant, I can't recommend the Conscious Conception course enough. It's like any question you have, I feel like can be answered by the course, whether you're trying to conceive or you are actively pregnant, which is really nice. So definitely check out that resource. The links for both her Instagram and her course are going to be in the show notes. Is there anything that you want to leave people with?
Ooh, that's a great question. I would just say, you know, pregnancy and preconception and conception, like all, even postpartum too. It, you know, a lot of women go into these phases with like really high expectations, and like oftentimes that puts a lot of stress on them or they put a lot of stress on themselves because of it. These phases are really beautiful and natural and primal. And there's only so much that we can control. And like, while I do preach about putting our best foot forward, just know that, you know, there's definitely a level of surrender that you have to walk into this stuff with. And to kind of, you know, prepare as much as you can, but also go with the flow and like give yourself grace if things don't go the way you expected, because that's also part of the journey and just letting it happen and kind of, you know, allowing things to unfold naturally. They're going to bring you so much less stress, and you might actually be more present for the process and get to enjoy more of it. So that's kind of what I would say in that regard.
I love that. I think that's a great message to leave women with, and hopefully, you know, just gives them a little more confidence and curiosity on this journey. Pregnancy can really change you and be an amazing thing. And while there's a lot of fear mongering out there, I think there is a lot of great information from practitioners like yourself as well. So hopefully this helps people find it. But thank you so much for joining us. I will see you when we do our live, and I'm sure I'll have you back on in the future.
Thanks again for having me. It's a blast as always.
Thank you for listening to the Are You Menstrual podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider leaving us a review and sharing the podcast with someone you think it will help. If you are new here, we can't recommend enough to start with our mineral imbalance quiz. This is going to give you an idea if you are at low, moderate, or high risk for mineral imbalances. And then, of course, make sure you follow us on Instagram at HormoneHealingRD and consider signing up for our newsletter. If you like nerding out and you are just loving these podcasts, but maybe you're a little bit more visual and you want to see things too, we go into a ton of detail in our weekly newsletter. So we would love to have you join us there. All right. Thank you. And we will see you in the next episode.